This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Assalamu alaikum, greetings of peace. Guess what? I just had a chance to interview a very well-known comedian.
Before I start tonight, I just wanted to read a brief statement that I prepared. I denounce anti-Semitism in all its forms. And that, Kanye, is how you buy yourself some time. Early in my career, I learned that there are two words in the English language that you should never say together in sequence. And those words are the and juice.
No. I'm not talking about Dave Chappelle.
You're a Muslim?
I am.
When did you become Muslim?
When I was 17.
If you're like me, you've been watching The Dean Show for now almost 20 years. Allah preserve our man Eddie and continue his work. Allah has opened for him a new door. We went from The Dean Show to The Dean Center, which is going to be in Florida. And I've been rooting for this project. I support it. I urge you to support it too. We know this brother and his work. He's got a track record that speaks for itself. This center is going to be successful, inshallah, as successful as the show is, and all his other dawah works. Go to the website, support it, and we look forward to seeing more good news coming out of there.
Or Bassem Youssef.
You have absolutely no sympathy for the Palestinian killing.
Even though the invitation is there for them, come, brothers, let's sit, let's talk. Now I'm talking about Jewish.
And I'm Jewish.
Comedian Dave Smith.
The Muslim world has had 1,000 9/11s.
Dave Smith went through early in his life believing all the mainstream propaganda talking points. But as a Jewish man, he really wished that they were true.
And I'm Jewish.
But now he's so passionate about what's happening in Palestine. He's had so many different debates. He's even helped his good friend, Joe Rogan.
Like, they've destroyed so much. Have you seen the footage, the recent footage?
It's crazy.
Mosques.
It's not
just
good.
Just bombing mosques.
Understand the situation in Palestine much, much better and clearer.
And I'm Jewish, so like, I grew up very much just only hearing the Israeli side of the story.
Hope you guys enjoy, because this is my interview with the Jewish comedian, political commentator, Dave Smith.
This is the Dean Show.
Good, I love you, man. I love all the work that you're doing.
When I was ready to talk about it, I would only talk to you.
And I was explaining how much respect I have for the faith of Islam.
Welcome to the Dean Show. The Dean Show.
Greetings and peace. Welcome to the Dean Show. And we got a special episode here with a special guest, Dave Smith. Not only is he a comedian, political commentator, but he's a man of reason and whose humanity is alive and well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I'm very happy to be talking with you.
I want to thank you. Thank you. I want to start off and commend you for having your humanity on, you know, and in this sad state that we see the world, where we have a modern day genocide happening. I was really impressed. I was watching how I got turned on to you. I was watching Joe Rogan.
It's basically, you can still get this in a Ben Shapiro video, you know, that millions of people watch, but it really will. Their story is just kind of like, all right, the Jews came here and we just said, hey, we want to be independent. And then in response to that, all the Arab nations attacked us. And then we just keep offering you peace. And they just keep saying no. And they just want, you know, we just want to live in peace and they just want to kill Jews. And that's the story. And there's nothing else that you need to know that's relevant here. But that's just so not true.
And just really into the way you were presenting the history and you were going into, remember that episode?
Yeah, of course. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I think it doesn't take too much to get there. You know, it's, I think that if people are being objective, basically, if you value human life, if you think all life is precious, I think you're going to end up coming to the conclusion that what's going on here is just wrong.
Let me ask you this. Have you ever sat like this? Like, you're sitting, you're Jewish, I'm Muslim. Have you ever sat with a Muslim like this?
I don't think so.
Are you scared?
No, I'm not. I think, you know, I grew up in New York City.
There's a lot of Muslims there.
So there's everything there, you know, and we, but like every... Our corner store was run by Muslims, and they were all like kind of, we were all very friendly and all kind of loved each other. Like their kids played basketball with us and stuff. And so it was never, I don't think I've ever like sat down and had a conversation about the state of Israel and Palestine with a Muslim. I'll tell you this, So I don't know why this just sticks out in my mind. But so anyway, so these guys who worked at the bodega down the street from me where I lived. And I knew them and I knew their kids. I'd known them for years. And we used to always kind of like bust each other's chops. That was like the spirit of things in the 80s and 90s in New York City. But it was always with love. And I remember one day, I don't know how the topic came up, but something about Israel came up. And I was like 10 years old or something like that. And I remember I said, the kid who was like maybe 15, 16, he said something about Israel. And I said back to him, and I go, what has Israel ever done to anybody? Because I had never heard, I didn't know anything about the history. I just heard what you hear as an American Jewish kid growing up. And I went, what has Israel ever done to anybody? And he just looks at his father and he goes, you see what they learn over here? You see? And his father was like, oh, okay. Because he just didn't want any problems. He's like, listen, we're running a business here. I'm not trying to like start up a huge fight. But I remember just having this moment where I saw that, you know, and I was like, oh, what is he like thinking that I like don't know? This, by the way, did not inspire anything. I didn't like go and start reading about it. I was a 10-year-old kid. I went and played basketball. But years later, when I started learning the history of it, I do remember thinking back to that moment and being like, oh, what must that be like from his perspective to have someone over here in America just be totally ignorant of the situation and just assume, but Israel's the good guys, right? And then he has to bite his tongue because his dad's like, okay, don't cause any problems for our business right now. But yeah, anyway, years later, I did some reading and I found out that there's actually quite a lot that they've done.
It reminded me when you were talking about, okay, New York, you're with the Muslims, you know, grocery store, they're part of the community there and people are getting along to stand. It reminded me of a rabbi, Rabbi Weiss and Shapiro and others who would kind of go into the history and they would narrate the same thing, that at one point in time, believe it or not, in Jerusalem, you had Muslims, Christians, and Jews, and particularly Jews and Muslims who were there together and they were living in a relative peace. They were watching each other's kids, and everything was good.
Until Zionism came about, Jews flourished as distinctly religious Jewish communities, and they weren't massacred. On the contrary, they went to these Arab and Muslim lands to escape persecution from the Crusades, from the Inquisition, and from many other trials and tribulations, and and even World War II. The Arab and Muslim lands opened their hearts, opened their lands, and provided a safe haven and a gracious hospitality for the Jewish people. We were respected, and even the Muslim religion requires of that, of the Muslim people to provide protection and hospitality, and they did carry that out. That's clear. Nobody could refute this.
Yes. Well, I mean, if you read the early Zionist writing, a lot of that actually comes across there. And obviously, they picked Palestine because of their, you know, connection to the Torah and stuff like that, religious reasons. But a lot of they don't mention Arabs that much in the early Zionist writings. And when they do, they mention them on kind of friendly terms. And there's this tremendous ignorance or naivete about them because these guys had never been to Palestine. These were all Eastern European Jews who were talking about what's in their book, but they had never actually been there and they didn't know these people. And so there were these assumptions that were very silly. You know, like, well, the Arabs could just maybe move. There's so many Arabs there. They could go to all these other Arab states, but that'd be, you know, it's as ridiculous as being like, well, a Dutch person could just go to England. I mean, they're all white, right? Like, who cares? They're all European or whatever, which is, you know, obviously silly. There's many differences between those cultures. But the point is that one of the reasons why they liked this is because they, relatively speaking, the Turks, the Ottoman Empire, the Arab world, had been pretty cool to the Jews. They didn't face nearly the persecution that they faced in Europe. And that's who the early Zionists are writing in response to, is the pogroms in Eastern Europe. And so, yeah, that's right. There had been Jewish people living in Palestine in relative harmony. I'm not saying, like, nothing violent ever happened, but relatively speaking, yeah, that's right. And, you know, as we were just talking about before we started recording, there is this narrative now that gets created that this is the Jews versus the Muslims. And that's just not true. That doesn't represent, I'm not saying there aren't any Jews who hate Muslims or there aren't any Muslims who hate Jews, but there's so many on both sides who don't don't have that attitude at all. And I think that's important for people to understand.
And that's why, you know, I was being facetious when I just made, you're a comedian, so I thought I can joke with you. Are you scared? But they're trying to have people now that we're fearing each other. Now, for Jews, Muslims to fear Jews, Jews to fear Muslims, and to have this this division now when you had at one point, I mean, and that's why I think these conversations are important. You know, like you said, you never actually sat and talked with a Muslim, you know, to talk, to understand each other, to reason, to go ahead and bring the human element to it. Because now it's, we're seeing in Palestine, they're trying to make the Palestinians like they're animals now, right? And we talked a little bit about that. But what did it for you? What did it for you that you actually, and I heard you say, I'm Jewish, and I wish the Israelis were right. So it's not easy for you.
Yeah, it would make life easier for me, like with family members and stuff like that.
Imagine.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And let's get this across the board. As a Muslim, this is not, if this was happening to Jews, I don't know if you've ever been to Harvard.
No.
Okay, if you go in Harvard in the law section, there's a verse of the Quran that says, talking about justice. So we're taught to be just, even if against our own family members, our own selves, our own community. Justice is a key principle in Islam. So if we're seeing injustice happening to no matter who it is, we're supposed to stand up against that injustice, just to make that point clear.
Right. Well, okay, so for me, I got really interested in politics in 2007, 2008, when Ron Paul was running for president.
Yeah.
And the centerpiece of Ron Paul's campaign and what really made him famous was this moment, this famous moment he had with Rudy Giuliani, where they were arguing at one of the debates. And what Ron Paul was arguing was that the George W. Bush narrative, which was the dominant narrative in, right after 9/11, was that they hate us for our freedom. And that's why you have this issue with radical Muslim terrorists who want to come over here and kill us, because we're free. And look, if that's true, but like if there is this group that wants to kill you just because you're free, well, then what's the answer? I mean, there's no other answer other than we better kill them before they come kill us. And so it leads you to turn your brain off and go, well, there's no other option except war. But what Ron Paul was arguing was that that's just not true. It's not true that people hate us because we're free, which, you know, for any human being, once you stop and think about that, doesn't really sound right anyway. But he goes, no, they hate us because we've been over there, and they hate us because we've been bombing their countries, because we've been propping up brutal dictators, because we have our military bases in their holy land. This is their beef. And as soon as he said that, it was like, well, that does make a lot more sense. And then I started just reading about it, and I realized he was completely right. And you could read this in their own words. This is what the terrorists were saying was the reason for hating us. In Osama bin Laden's letter to America, he says, why do we attack you? Because you attack us. And that this was, and when you started to understand that, there's something tragic about it all, but there's also something kind of beautiful in the sense that you realize that it's like, oh, this actually really makes us more similar than different. Because really, what was the whole attitude in America after 9/11? It was like, you came and hit us, and now we're gonna go hit you back. And then you realize, you're like, oh, that's the same attitude that they have. And once you kind of realize that there's more that we have in common than that separates us, then you know, if they hate us for our freedom, then there's no other answer but war. But if we're actually all kind of more similar than different, there's a path toward peace. You go, oh, well, maybe if we stopped doing this to them, then they wouldn't want to do this back to us. And so there's something beautiful in there. And anyway, in the years following that, I just got totally obsessed with libertarianism and the history of war and other stuff, too, economics and things like that, too. But then I started really reading about the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And it was, I'll just say, wildly different than the narrative that I had been presented growing up.
I remember when you were sitting with Joe Rogan, and then you had mentioned this, and then you went into, you said, okay, this is what the slogan, this is what we're being fed, that they also, something like, they just want to eradicate the Jews because...
And I'm Jewish, so like I grew up very much just only hearing the Israeli side of the story. And it's basically, you can still get this in a Ben Shapiro video, you know, that millions of people watch. But it really will. Their story is just kind of like, the Jews came here and we just said, hey, we want to be independent. And then in response to that, all the Arab nations attacked us. And then we just keep offering you peace. And they just keep saying no. And they just want, you know, we just want to live in peace. And they just want to kill Jews. And that's the story. And there's nothing else that you need to know.
that's relevant here. But that's just so not true.
What were you saying exactly? I remember.
Well, it's,
and then you went into the hit, then you informed Joe actually what was going on. You were very well versed in the history and everything.
Well, I've read a ton about it. I think I've read all the best people and some bad people on it. But there's always the slogans, the Israeli slogans. You know, it was a people without land for a land without people.
So that's one of the slogans.
That's one of the slogans, that, like, as if there were no people living there or something, which is just, it's an objective claim that can be tested, and you can prove that there were in fact people there. It's just factually false. And they also say, you know, they never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. There's no partner for peace. But the more you examine it, just none of that's actually right. It's not true. And then there's very strong historical evidence that, in fact, there were many times where they had a partner for peace, the Palestinians have never really been given an opportunity exactly. But the story, basically, the way it's presented in the West, and this is changing dramatically now, of course, because there's shows like this and there's shows like mine.
You're
and,
seeing the shit.
Yes, yeah. Well, there's not like a monopoly of the control of information the way there always was. But the story would basically be, they go, well, look, so you had some Jews and some Arabs all living in this strip of land, and the Jews wanted to have their own state, and they declared independence, and then all of the surrounding Arab countries attacked them, and now the Jews just want to live in peace, but they get these rockets fired at them all the time, and so don't they have a right to defend themselves? That's essentially, I'm not really caricaturing it, that's essentially what gets told to Americans, or what has been told to them for many, many decades. And sure, if that were the story, then it totally makes sense to just blindly support Israel, because, like, yeah, they have a right to exist, and they have a right. But again, it's just that is a funhouse mirror version of what really happened.
It goes back to where we started earlier, where we were talking about, okay, that same statement that was for the Iraq War, talking about that they just hate us because of our freedoms and our way of life. You said something really powerful. I shared it, and the people were like, man, you got to get this guy on the show. You said something about, well, they've had 1,000 9/11s.
The Muslim world has had 1,000 9/11s. And if you sit here and go, look, just imagine, try to imagine, be really genuine here, okay? Because we're going to say it, we're so much better than the Islamic world. And imagine, not one 9/11, but 1,000 9/11s happened here. What would that look like? And then let's say, after 1,000 9/11s happened here, let's say, whoever, Iran did it. And then Iran invades and they overthrow our government. And they prop up their own government. And now they rule us. What do you think the toughest right-wing militia members in America would be doing? They'd be throwing Molotov cocktails through their government building. They'd be running up, suicide bombing themselves. And I bet they'd yell something about Jesus before they did it too. Because they'd probably start clinging to their religion. So I'm just saying that, like, if we're unwilling in this debate, in this divide, try, make a real effort to put ourselves in their shoes and go, what would we do in that situation?
Something like that. Do you remember?
Yeah, well, that's
what exactly you said?
Well, Laura Loomer, it was in the debate
with her.
That was
in that debate, huh?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and she was saying something about, you know, how, you know, because it's easy to look, especially from a Western perspective, it's easy to look at any of the most radical elements of Islam and say, well, look how horrible this is, right? And I was just making the point that I was like, well, look how much America lost their minds after 9/11. We got hit with a 9/11 and we just launched these catastrophic wars that, again, not even against the people who did 9/11, against the Taliban, who was, I mean, the Taliban was as guilty as a landlord who rents an apartment to somebody who kills someone. You know what I mean? Like, you don't go after the landlord for that. I don't know. I just rented this guy an apartment. What is, you know? And Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11, and not to mention, neither did Muammar Gaddafi or Bashar al-Assad or, you know, the Houthis in Yemen or any of the people who we've, you know, conducted military campaigns against since then. And we lost our mind like that after one 9/11. So, you know, I'm just saying, if you just look at it in terms of, like, numbers of people, like a few thousand people got killed. But what would any, imagine 1,000 9/11s happened. And how, you know, how much that would throw this country into chaos and all of that. So all I'm saying is, like, if you're going to look down with judgment against any of these countries will consider what's been done to them. I think that's reasonable to say, okay, like, yes, if that had been done to us, we would also have some problems going around. And of course, what would happen in that environment is the most radical voices end up being elevated, and that's who people rally around. In the same way that Americans rallied around George W. Bush, who was saying, we're gonna go get all you guys, because when you're hit and you're vulnerable and you're scared, you look for a protector. So whoever the strongest guy around you is, and quite oftentimes that's not the person advocating peace, that's the person advocating aggression.
And then to see you be a voice of reason, and to see you even at that time, why do you think it is most people, they're not just using their critical thinking skills and, you know, looking and just swallowing the narrative, you know, and not, and right now the slogan was for a long time, you know, you had this evil event that happened, the Holocaust, something that was evil, that was, and then after that, it was like a never again, and this was supposed to be something that's across the board. We don't want to see that to any group of people, right. But we're seeing it in 4K. So that slogan, never again, it was like, okay, how does that now, when you're talking to, let's say, colleagues, friends, you know, your people, reactions to some of the things that you're saying, how's been the feedback?
It's, you know, it's been a mixed bag. I mean, it's obviously, it's a very hotly, you know, emotional issue. And I think that I've certainly had some people who were very upset with me for taking this position. I don't really care about that. The personal stuff, like family members and stuff like that, that's been more, you know, difficult. But then I've also had a tremendous response of people who really appreciate that I didn't kind of buckle on my principles in this situation, just because it's such an emotional one. Because the truth is, like, these are my principles across the board. I mean, even when whatever the situation might be, if any government was, like, as you said before, if any government was doing this to any other group of people, I would condemn that. And when there have been, look, I'm a libertarian by definition. I believe all governments are criminal organizations, and there have been plenty of Muslim governments that have done awful things. I've been highly, highly critical of what the Saudis have done to the people of Yemen over the last 8 or 9 years. I mean, it's just absolutely inexcusable. And now, of course, the U.S. was backing that war as well. But I think that I'm, as a man, as a father, I think that my job has to be to tell the truth. Tell the truth as I see it, and that, let the chips fall where they may. I kind of decided a long time ago that's what I'm going to do, and so I try to do that in this situation as well. And it's not that I'm not sitting here and saying that there's more radical positions than what I take on this. I'm certainly not sitting here and saying that no Arab has ever done anything wrong, and in this long conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians, that there's never been anything wrong done on the other side. And I absolutely condemn any aggression towards civilians. I do not think is legitimate. Even if you're being occupied, even if you're being dominated, I think it is not justified to kill or to hurt innocent civilians. I can also understand that I can say that with the benefit of sitting thousands of miles away and not being in that situation. But, you know, I have two little kids, and if somebody ever hurt one of my little kids, I could see how I might get to a place where I'm ready to go hurt your kid to get back at you. I'm not saying that's justified, it's not, but you can also understand it. I also think, just for strategic reasons, I think that the Palestinians' embrace of terrorism in many different stages of this conflict has been a strategic failure. I think that terrorism has been embraced in many, terrorism as a response to occupation has been embraced in many parts of the world before, and also, by the way, for people who know the history, by Zionists in Israel. But right before the creation of Israel, the Zionists were committing acts of terrorism to the British.
What were those two main groups? The Ergon and
the Haganah was the biggest one, and then there's there were a couple of the Ergon and the Stern.
They're actually United States terror.
Are they? Yeah. I mean, they were openly talking about how they embraced terrorism as a tactic, and this did help to drive the British out. I think the main strategic error, and I'm not talking morality here, I'm just saying the strategic error, is that the use of terrorism to drive out the French or the British, like a colonial power, is different than dealing with settler colonialism, where these people are not going back anywhere. The whole mission is to make this their home country. And so I think that backfired. I also think there were atrocities committed by Palestinians. But if you look at the history of the situation as a whole, what you can't get away from is that the story here is that a group of Europeans decided they wanted to create a state in a land where there were already occupants who had been living there for thousands of years. And they came in and they essentially from the beginning started kicking them out. And a lot of people on the Zionist side, they'll try to kind of spin this thing where it's like, well, before 1947, the Jews were buying the land. And when you live in, say, like a capitalist society like we live in, when you say buying the land, that what you immediately think of is like, oh, that's peaceful. You know, I bought my house from the last person who owned my house, and that means we both agreed on a price, and he moved his stuff out, and I moved my stuff in, and now it's legitimately my house. But that's not the history, because it wasn't a capitalist system. It was much closer to like a feudalist system under the Ottoman Empire. And the way it worked was basically the Ottomans just claimed ownership of the entire thing, and then they would basically bribe tribal leaders by giving them plots of land. Now, on these plots of land, there were people who had built homes and who had built farms and were living there. And some, you know, maybe someone from Beirut would come in and say, hey, I got this piece of paper. This is my plot of land. And the local Palestinian would say, well, what do you mean? I built a house. I've been living here. And they'd say, well, I own it, and you better give me 10% of what you make every year if you want to live here. So they basically kind of, you know, bully them into robbing a little bit of money from them. But when the Jewish Fund came out and they said, because they had big international financing backing them, and they said, hey, listen, if you're a Jew anywhere, we will pay your way and buy you land if you go join this project and move to Palestine. So they would pay them. And then, but the condition was you cannot have an Arab on that land. They can't even work the land. And so now, rather than someone from Lebanon coming over and—
Who made this condition now?
This was the Jewish Fund, the international fund that would pay for your way, but you could not have an Arab on the land. So now it's not just some
guy. Why not?
Because they wanted to create a Jewish homeland, and they knew from the very beginning that transfer, as they call it, would be an essential part of this project.
That's not like the common slogan is, that's the only democracy.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you overlook a whole lot of other elements, then you could kind of call it a democracy. Like, if you just look in here, yeah, but don't zoom out here, you could say it's a democracy. But anyway, so now it's not just some guy from Lebanon coming over and saying, hey, I claim I own this, even though it's totally illegitimate by any like modern Western capitalist standpoint. It's not legitimate ownership of land. But he says, hey, you got to give me 10%. I mean, that's one thing. That's you getting shaken down for 10%. But now it's a Zionist settler saying, hey, I own this land. Get out. You know, this house that you built or your grandfather built, that's mine now. I'm kicking you out of it. You can't even work the land here anymore. I won't even give you a job on this farm.
What example, if you flip that for us here, Americans living, if someone came over and was like doing the same exact thing.
And said, the British Empire gave me this piece of paper that says I own your house. You go, the British Empire doesn't even exist anymore. Because this is after the fall of the Ottoman Empire. This was happening. It was an old piece of paper from the Ottoman Empire. They had collapsed. This is post-World War I. They had collapsed already. So that's how that's when they refer to, oh, they were just buying land. So as you can see clearly, anyone, if you, with anything like in the tradition of Western liberalism, classical liberalism or libertarianism, like if you read John Locke, this is not, the people who homesteaded the land are the rightful owners of it, not the people who had some piece of paper from some colonial empire that's dead. It made no sense. But so this started building up a lot of tension, and there's just a lot of, there was conflict back and forth. But again, zooming out, what happened is a group of Europeans decided they wanted to set up a state in an area where that was already inhabited, and that first through this buying land process started moving them out. And then, of course, fast forward to 47, the United Nations, a group of European powers, no one within thousands of miles of, or I forget the exact numbers, but it's not like all the closest members who were like anywhere near Palestine all voted against the partition recommendation. The Europeans decided that since what happened to these people in Europe was so bad, that they should get the majority of this land that had already been inhabited. And then when creating the State of Israel came into existence, because I know there's a lot of people, like I just heard Benny Morris the other day, and he's arguing like, yes, there was talk of transfer, but it wasn't necessarily inherent. And if the Arabs had taken the partition recommendation, then maybe there wouldn't have been this transfer. But all of that is irrelevant. That's what would have maybe happened. None of us know what would have happened if things had been done differently. But what did happen was that in the ballpark of 750,000 Arabs were either forcefully kicked out or fled and weren't allowed back. So they were in effect ethnically cleansed out of this area and basically have been refugees ever since. And then in 1967, Israel took obviously control of the West Bank and Gaza, and they've had it the whole time. And you can get lost in the minutia of every little thing, and you go through the first Antifada or the second Antifada or any of this, but the bottom line is that these people have lived under totalitarianism since 1967, and that is unacceptable.
Yeah, and you can spin anything. I mean, you get into sure. many of these things and you'll see things being spun, but if you look at human rights organizations, even Jews who, like you, yourself, you have your humanity on, Tentura. Have you seen the film Tentura?
I have not. I'm familiar.
Heard of it?
Yeah, I'm familiar.
You have the historian that you mentioned earlier. What was it? Jewish
Ilan Pape.
Ilan Pape and others, academics. Yeah. It was a Jewish historian with the Tentura film. And actually, he was a film writer or academic, and he came out and he collected all of these reports of what was happening in this town. There was just one town mm-hmm. of the many. And these atrocities that were happening, and then they went after him. So what really gets people to thinking is, why would you have people like yourself, you're Jewish, Jewish historians, active people on the ground there who just are seeing the injustice? You know, it's part of our nature to be against injustices, and they're coming out.
Look, I used to be a Zionist. As you mentioned, I'm a Holocaust survivor. Zionism was very important for me as a salvation of the Jewish people, until I found out that the state was founded based on the extirpation, the expulsion, and multiple massacres of the local population. And that's not historically controversial.
You know, and then you have these human rights organizations, Amnesty International, the human rights organization is in Israel calling it an apartheid state, that it is the UN saying that it is occupied.
Well,
and
I mean,
how do you spin that stuff?
Well, it's very, because...
And then there's one more.
Sure,
There's one more. You mentioned when you were talking that I was really disappointed because I was kind of, I was telling you before, I was planning to have RFK on the program. We had been speaking back then when he had the Instagram still. And then to hear him talking to you...
Deeply disappointed and frankly, kind of dumbfounded by your position on Israel's war in Gaza.
And there was... many points, solid points, things that you were bringing up. One of them was he brought up the meeting at the was it Camp David,
mm-hmm.
and then you just shut that down so beautifully. You talked about there was a book by a Schweizer,
Swisher, Clayton Swisher,
the truth about Camp David.
Yes.
Read Clayton Swisher's book, The Truth About Camp David. This guy went around and spent 3 years interviewing everyone who was a part of those negotiations. And the official story that Arafat just walked away and he had such a good offer, but he wouldn't take it, is not true. And all of the players involved admit this.
And then this is what just blew my mind. You quoted an Israeli prime minister who said, I wouldn't even take that deal.
Shlomo Ben-Ami. The Israeli foreign minister during the negotiations said, if I was a Palestinian, I never would have taken the deal we were offering them.
Well, it was Shlomo Ben-Ami, the foreign minister.
Yeah.
And he was a foreign minister during the Camp David negotions, where he was acting foreign minister.
That's one of those things, again,
yes.
they bring up and said, they're against peace. They don't want peace. They just want to eradicate the Jews.
Well, look, this is true from all throughout Israeli history. Is that there's examples over and over and over again of the top level Israeli officials admitting it. And admitting not just that there's this great, I learned this from Daryl Cooper, has a an amazing podcast series. It's a real time investment.
That's
something
the one you recommended to Joe Rogan.
Yes, it's yes. Like I think it's like between 26 to 30 hours. It's basically a book on tape.
Yeah.
But he is just so brilliant and just knows so much about the history.
What's it called again?
It's called Fear and Loathing in the New Jerusalem.
And people can go listen to this for free, right?
Yes, it's free. It's a Martyr Made podcast is the name of the podcast. It's really just so well done. And I'll tell you something about it. What's really amazing about it too is that he's really not taking sides. He's really telling you the story, and he's also saying, like, hey, look, put yourself in their position, put yourself in the position of someone who was the victim of pogroms and the victims of the Holocaust and all of this, and you may get to a certain point where maybe you're just sick and tired of being the victim, and let's not worry about, okay, yeah, this may not exactly be right, but what, we're going to get killed if we don't do this, and then put yourself in the position of people who were living in this land and then get this imposed, and he just goes through the history, but there's lots of little nuggets that were very interesting from it, things I didn't know, even though I had read a lot about this, but so there's this one example. In 1956, Moshe Dayan, who famously he is known for being, he was the defense minister during the 1967 war, but this is before, a few years before that. This is in 56, and there was an Israeli lieutenant who got killed by a couple Arabs right outside of Gaza, and Moshe Dayan gave his eulogy at his funeral. And he's saying this from a pro-Israel perspective. He's not like a pro-Palestinian by any sense of the word. But he says in this eulogy, he says to the effect, this is pretty close to the quote, he goes, let us not judge the Arabs who killed this lieutenant. Because how could we blame them? We drove them from their land, and now they're sitting in refugee camps watching us build a land on what was previously their land. Of course they're going to hate us. We'd hate them, too, if they had done that to us. And he goes on to justify it. He's like, but, you know, this is correct, and so we must create the state of Israel, and if that's what it costs, that's what it costs. But he admits right there, they don't hate us for our freedom. They hate us because we drove them off their land. Ehud Barak, former Israeli prime minister, said, if I was a young Palestinian, I would be a terrorist too. I would join one of these terrorist groups.
Who's saying that now?
That was Ehud Barak, the former prime minister. The prime minister before Benjamin Netanyahu. And so, and there's countless examples of stuff like this. And so that's the point I was making. Shlomo Ben-Ami said, I wouldn't have taken this deal if I was the Palestinians either, because it's such a bad deal. But then it gets spun like, oh, we offered them everything, and they just wouldn't take it. And so, look, at the end of Daryl Cooper's podcast, the conclusion that he comes to, which I know people will laugh off or dismiss, you know, laugh up, but dismiss is like naive. But he was just making the point that, look, these two people, the Jewish people and the Palestinian people, they have a deeply interwoven history at this point, you know? And there's just kind of no getting away from that. And there, whatever the solution to this problem, like a peaceful solution, is, it's never going to be perfect. It's not going to be what everybody wants. But to just start with at least an admission that, look, this happened and it was wrong, it is actually a very powerful thing. And that there is at least some type of reconciliation, of acknowledging that this did happen, it was wrong, okay, we have to move forward from here. In the same sense, you know, a lot of people will say to me when I start talking like this, they'll go, oh, so Dave, are you saying we should give the land back to the Native Americans in America? And it's like, well, no, that's not exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying it was wrong what was done to them, and we can acknowledge that. And for any Native Americans who are still around, they should have their rights protected. They should not live under totalitarianism. And I do not take the position, as I'm sure some people do, and I understand where there would be some Arabs who would take this position, that basically all of it should be returned to the Palestinians, and that, you know, from the river to the sea ought to all be Palestine. Of course, there are Zionists who take the position that from the river to the sea ought to all be Israel. I'm not taking that position. I'm saying that, look, we're generations later at this point, and as history is riddled with injustices, and you can't go back and undo every single one of them. But you can at least some point say, look, this occupation has to end. This war in Gaza right now has to end. The idea that there has to be some type of compromise where you recognize that it's like, okay, I don't think Israel's going anywhere. Although, you know, if they keep pushing it like this, maybe they actually might put themselves in jeopardy. because they are turning international opinion against them so rapidly at this point. But I think there is, I don't believe that it's impossible for there to be a peaceful solution to this. And I think that actually there were lots of opportunities in the past where that really could have happened.
I saw you very frustrated. I was also watching you talk with, debate with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I was someone who admired some of his previous work, and to see him, someone who's a environmentalist, to see someone who's kind of he had that humanity that was on with many other issues, but with this now, to even use his voice to say cease fire, stop.
Yeah,
he's asking you know some questions that I was just so surprised. I was shocked that he was trying to also equate the Palestinians, the Jews there, the Zionists there, with indigenous people like the Native Americans.
It's unbelievable. Oh my God, it's just painful to watch. And trying to equate Hamas to the Nazis as if there's any real comparison to that. You know, and I said to him at one point, I go, you know, the Nazis controlled almost all of Europe, and Hamas doesn't even control Gaza. Mm-hmm. Like how do you even make this comparison?
And then he opened up and he said pretty much that, summarizing what he said, it's pretty much, he said the ideology, but he's pretty much saying this is Islam versus Jews, pretty much.
It's an ideology-driven conflict that's not territorial and has no negotiating position.
And then he left the impression that it was just they want to kill all Jews.
That is committed to the genocide of all Jews, not only in Israel, but all over the world.
And I want to just put this to rest. This is something, as a Muslim, we talked about the history there, that they were, and we have Orthodox rabbis and others, you know, historians who documented that.
Palestinian groups, leaders, military groups saying, we have nothing against Jews. We tolerate Jews. We lived with Jews thousands of years together. The 300,000 people left Spain. Where did they live to? China? Japan? Australia? No. They left to Turkey. They left to Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, Albania in the Second World War. It was a small Muslim country. And they had a few thousand Jews there. Nazis Germany has occupied Albania. But none single Jew was killed in Albania. You know where the Muslims were hiding the Jews? They were hiding them in mosques, in basements, in all types of places. And they saved all these 5,000 Jews in Albania. We're going to live together as the same as it was everywhere, as the same as Jews lived in Turkey, Algeria, Morocco, in Iran, till now, peacefully, in harmony, without any problems. In
Jerusalem was somewhat a place of peace. Okay, right. You might have isolated incidents, okay, sure. This and the other, but I don't know if you know the story of Omar, the second caliph of Islam.
Did
you
know the story?
When the Jews were, it's a very interesting story, it's documented that when the Jews were forbidden from being in Jerusalem, and he conquered, you know, this is before Salahuddin Ayyubi, mm-hmm. And he conquered this area. Sophronius was the person that was the person in charge from the Christian side. And then he said, where are the Jews at? And he said, we drove them out. And he ended up repopulating, bringing in 70 or somewhat 80s families, and he repopulated the community of the Jews.
He says, where is the caliph? And the guy on the camel does like this. He nods with his head at the guy leading the camel. So Sophronius turns to the guy leading the camel and goes, where's the caliph? And the guy leading the camel says, I'm the caliph. And Sophronius goes, dude, you're dressed in rags. The guy's pants were mended multiple times. His shirt was mended multiple times. And he goes, no, I'm the caliph. And Sophronius goes, you've just conquered Iraq and Syria and all of Palestine minus Jerusalem. How is it you're so poor? And the caliph goes, well, why would I collect wealth? We're not doing this war because I'm trying to plunder anything. I'm a humble man with humble needs. I just need good meal. And then Sophronius goes, why aren't you riding the camel? And Omar goes, that's my servant on the camel, and we take turns so that neither one of us gets exhausted. At this point, Sophronius is like, oh, what? Who just conquered us? And then Sophronius goes, oh, but you're gonna like seize property in the city. And so, and the caliph goes, no, no, we're not gonna take anybody's property. We're gonna leave the city exactly like it is. The only thing I wanna do is eject the Roman politicians with whatever they can carry. And Sophronius goes, there's nothing to negotiate. Yeah, we surrender the city this instant. I don't understand, actually. At that point, the caliph says, I want to see the Temple Mount. And Sophronius goes, why? And the caliph goes, because it's holy. It's holy to everybody. It's holy to Christians, it's holy to Jews, it's holy to Muslims. And Sophronius goes, nah, we haven't been treating it as holy to anybody. And Omar ibn al-Khattab goes, what do you mean? And so Sophronius says, so after we tore down the second temple of Solomon, when we conquered Palestine, we turned the Temple Mount into a garbage dump to punish the Jews. And the caliph goes, what do you mean? And Sophronius goes, yeah, there's like 500 years of refuse on that thing. It's just a garbage dump. And he goes, show me. They walk up to the Temple Mount, and the caliph can't believe what he's looking at. He falls on his knees and he begins clearing the garbage by his hands. His army sees their leader on his knees clearing garbage, and they run up and they start clearing the garbage themselves. And they clear the garbage off the Temple Mount. The caliph goes, okay, I want to meet some of the Jews living in Jerusalem. And Sophronius goes, there are no Jews in Jerusalem. And the caliph goes, what do you mean there's no Jews in Jerusalem? The city is holy to the Jews. How can there be no Jews? And he says, well, us Christians, we pretty much murder them every chance we get. We really hate Jews. In fact, in the war we just did against the Persians, the Jews sided with the Persians. And so we murdered 20,000 Jews in Jerusalem and completely purged the city of its remaining Jewish population. And Omar ibn al-Khattab goes, no, this is wrong. You can't do this. And so he turns to a convert to Islam, a Jewish convert to Islam, and he says, I need you to find me 80 Jewish families that were willing to volunteer to move to Jerusalem so we can reestablish a Jewish presence in this city. And that's how the Muslims conquered Jerusalem. And that's the stuff that's left out of your history books.
So my question is, if Muslims hated Jews and if it was a part of the ideology, one, during the Holocaust, where did the Jews flee? Where did they flee? If you have places in Albania and Bosnia, where my family's from, to this day you have Jews there in Turkey and places.
And was it in Algeria where they protected the Jews when the Nazis were trying to get them?
Hit them in mosques, yeah, in basements, you know, forging documents. So from that, if it was a part of the ideology, Islam, to hate Jews, why would they, when the Nazis are coming, knocking on the door, saying, give up the Jews, right. they're actually lying to protect the Jews.
Right.
Why? It doesn't make any sense.
So it's clearly not inherent in the religion.
No, it's not.
It's not inherent.
So then I would challenge, you know, someone like, and it's not, you know, this other person that you debated, she also had stated, she said to be a devout Muslim, you have to hate Jews. So
yeah.
These are the kind of things. And then people actually, they hear this and then they're just like, is that true? Is that for real? And then you start developing this fear. That's why I asked
right.
you, to be, are you scared of being a Christian, right? So, but when you really know history, when you read, when you study, this is something that also when you look at, you know, a Muslim is allowed to marry a Jew.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that, yeah.
Okay. This is basic stuff, right?
Right.
Prophet Muhammad, he had two Jewish wives, right?
Okay, I didn't know that.
You know, and so the point is, if you're allowed to marry a Jewish woman,
yeah, right.
and you're supposed to hate her at the same time, that marriage is not going to work, right?
Well,
it's kosher food. We're allowed to eat, would you have halal meat? If it's kosher food, we're allowed to eat. Jews can actually pray in a mosque. They cannot pray in a church. I don't know if you knew that. Oh. So these are just basic points. If people knew these things, the most honored woman in Islam is a Jewish woman. You know her name? What her name is?
No.
Mary, the mother of Jesus.
Oh, right. Okay.
There's a whole chapter named after her in the Quran. So this is nonsensical.
Yeah.
Yes, we hated injustice. Yes, there was people, there was groups who did treachery. That's a different story. We can talk about that. But in a general context, this is anti-Islam to be anti-Jewish.
That's very interesting. And, you know, I think that it's kind of like, it's very similar to the narrative after 9/11 that they hate us for our freedom. And so if that's true, then you have to throw your hands up in the air and there's nothing you can do to solve that. And in a similar sense, if it were inherent to Islam to hate Jews, well then, we can't really solve that problem. And so it's nice to, it's actually very helpful to learn that that's not the case. And I remember, you know, like,
And I want to issue a $10,000 or more challenge to that that lady or anyone else, because she said it's all over the Quran more than in Kempf of Hitler. There's some money on the table if you can go ahead and find it. Deliver,
yeah,
please.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think you're going to get a response from that, but it's good. It's a good offer to put out there. I mean, I remember one of the things that I read about after 9/11, after I got into Ron Paul and all this stuff, and you know, is they hate us for our freedom thing, and I thought it was very interesting that when after World War I, when the U.S. Formed the King Crane Commission, and they went into the Middle East, and they were doing like mass surveys, and they were trying to figure out who Syria wanted to rule them under a League of Nations mandate, and they overwhelmingly went for the United States of America. Because they liked America. They didn't like the British and the French because they had been colonizing them. But America was like the city on a hill. And they're about freedom. We would like them. And so it's like, oh, no, they didn't hate us for our freedom. They actually loved us.
Have you watched
when they thought we were afraid.
A documentary called Dirty Wars?
Yes. Yeah, Jeremy Scahill. Yes.
Okay, you've seen that documentary. Mm-hmm. So you got people like having a wedding. They're hanging out in their farm, their cave, wherever in Afghanistan. Next thing you know, you got a drone from 10,000 miles up blowing up your family, blowing up the wedding. You're going to create some enemies.
Yes, exactly. That's right. And anybody would respond in that way. And look, think of the amount of anti-Muslim feelings that arose in America after 9/11. You know, this is it's not justified. It's not fair to blame all Muslims for what a group of Muslims did. However, it is also a very predictable human outcome that if you're attacked by a group of people, the level of resentment against that group of people is going to rise. And so this is also what I've been saying from the very beginning. I was like, look, if you're actually concerned about anti-Semitism, if you're concerned about people hating Jews, well then what Netanyahu is doing is the worst thing you could possibly do, because this is guaranteed to make more people hate Jewish people. You know, like, just, and I'm not saying that's justified, but like, if you live in a neighborhood and a bunch of black people come in and start beating people up, is the level of prejudice against black people going to go up or down? It's going to go up, because that's the way human beings are, unfortunately. And so if you actually wanted to create a world with less Jew hatred, then you'd be completely against the way they've been conducting this war in Gaza. And then, of course, the other thing, and this has been true for the history of Zionism, is that they kind of have this weird symbiotic relationship with hatred of Jewish people. And in fact, they kind of like it and kind of benefit from it. And they, because look, so even at the beginning of the rise of the Nazis, there were many of the Zionists at the time who were kind of pleased with it. Because what? It was, they were telling all the Jews to leave Europe. And that's the same thing the Zionists were telling them. Like, leave Europe and come here. That's right. The more inhospitable it is in Europe, the more people might want to come here and help us with our project here. And of course, this is part of the reason why Netanyahu has explicitly stated that he was supporting Hamas for many years. Because having a group that you can point to as terrorists, that allows him to say, I have no partner for peace. That allows him to continue the occupation and continue the blockade, right? And so there's this weird dynamic where it does seem like oftentimes these people kind of benefit from each other. And who suffers for it, for the most part, of the Palestinian people, and to a lesser extent, the people of Israel, too, because they get caught in the middle of, acts of terrorism and military campaigns and all this stuff.
Speaking about 9/11, and it reminded me, I just saw this clip, this program with a friend of yours that was up not too long ago, and we were talking about these wars and what was happening, and I want to get your reaction to this.
As a bank, really, for these wars is because Americans don't know anything. We know very, after 9/11, I think about it now, the propaganda to make me afraid of Muslims. I can't even imagine being a Muslim growing up after 9/11 in America, because I know how I felt about them. And I was young, I was 11 years old, but that beating every day in our heads that every Muslim was a terrorist was the idea that you got.
I make jokes about it, but like, you don't understand, like I had to shave my face to go to airports. My mom would make me shave my face. Yeah. Like at school, like I was so young, this is actually funny. I had a mustache in like the fourth grade, and my mom made me nair it. Because she was like, you got to like, because it was really, really bad. Because whatever you're like, the household would say the kids have no filter. Mm-hmm. So they would just say whatever they wanted to me. But at a young age, I realized that I myself as a Middle Eastern was racist too. I was like, oh, it's not us, it's them. Mm-hmm. And so I would point my finger out of fear. I'm like, no, they did it. But then I went to I went to Saudi Arabia. And I don't think I've ever been to a country that was more hospitable to me. Mm-hmm. The love that I got, the respect that I got, I literally sat back and I hung myself out to dry on a podcast. I go, wow, I was brainwashed. I was so scared. I didn't bring her.
Yeah, same. And so first I want to say just like, to all Muslims growing up during that time in America, I am sorry on behalf of America
for
the way that you were treated. It is so unacceptable. When I go back and I re-examine that propaganda, that brainwashing that took place in the classroom to make me scared of something, I didn't even know what a Muslim was. I remember going to the airport and someone was a Hindu and I was scared of him. Like, oh my God, they're gonna take this off of his head, blah, blah. I thought that was a Muslim, right? Mm-hmm. There was no education about anything. And the reason for that, you know, he who controls the textbooks controls the entire country, in my view, right? It was because everything that we did responding to 9/11 should be assessed as whether or not they were crimes against humanity. We bombed 1 million Iraqi civilians. We killed 1 million Iraqis. What were we doing in Iraq? The Saudis were on the plane. They just said there's weapons of mass destruction. And then they never found them. But they, in the process, they killed 1 million Iraqi civilians, right? And it made us think it's okay to just keep bombing Muslims. That was the purpose to me of that educational propaganda and brainwashing, is that we feel nothing for Muslims if they die.
She's been really great on all this stuff. I'm very impressed with Candace. She's very smart and really courageous and willing to take positions that are not going to make her life easier. But yeah, I think
she's also being a person like you, a person of reason now.
I think so.
Her humanity is on. She was also calling, you know, she quoted something about blessed are the peacemakers, and you know, to see what's happening, this genocide, and now she's speaking up, but then to get attacked from one side.
Yeah, well, there's kind of no way to not get attacked from one side or the other in this. But again, as I was kind of saying before, that it's like, this is the way, you know, the way these things always work. This is true with every government and with every gang and with every, is that there are the, who suffers are the innocent people. And then you have very, obviously, look, there is real corruption in Gaza too. There's corruption with Hamas getting this money from through Qatar and not using it for, you know what I mean? Like the people, and instead some of them are, a bunch of them got to Qatar and they're living rich there now and stuff like that. That's very corrupt as well. There's corruption. There's all types of corruption in the Israeli government. I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu is largely motivated by the fact that he might end up in prison if this war doesn't continue. I mean, there were protests about hundreds of thousands in the streets in Israel right before this. So you see this dynamic where it like kind of gave him a lifeline, you know, which is like so sickening, because now like for your own political purposes, you must, you know, engage in this mass slaughter campaign. But the bottom line is that one of the things that's kind of been exposed during this latest war in Gaza is the new landscape that we live in now, and how this is not the same scenario it was in the 80s or 90s or something like that. That there's all these independent shows, and the amount of graphic footage out of this conflict is unlike anything I've ever seen. I mean, even in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, I mean, we got some footage out of it, but it would mostly be like aerial footage and seeing like a strike come in, and you're kind of removed from the, but I mean, the amount of like, I mean, babies dying under rubble, people are seeing this every day. And I, at least maybe there's some hope that this just won't be able to continue. Obviously, it's been able to continue up to this point, but.
Let me ask you this.
Sure.
Just a couple more questions. I was supposed to have, I did a show program, the first one I did with Max Blumenthal. He's an award-winning independent journalist. He's written for the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, and now he's with the Gray Zone. Mm-hmm. And I had him listen to Chris Cuomo. You've heard of Chris Cuomo? And Chris Cuomo was talking about this film that they had seen, or not a film, this presentation by the Israeli government to certain reporters. And then he came out and he did a report talking about charred bodies, this, that, and the other, really gruesome things, disgusting things. And I am not a card-carrying member of Hamas. I like hummus.
I love hummus.
I love hummus, but look, I'm not somebody who's was really unfamiliar with many of the groups and that. And but I, obviously, you see the injustice, and you're speaking on a side of truth. That's what you're trying to do. My point here is, so Max Blumenthal, when we showed this, he called out Chris Cuomo because Max had done a lot of reporting on this and talking about the Hannibal Directive. Mm-hmm. He was talking about many of the Israeli newspapers who were also reporting on things that were contradicting the official story. And I was like, hold on. I mean, it's like, okay. So then Chris contacted me. He reached out to us and he wanted to come on the program. And have a discussion with Max. So we were going back and forth, and then I finally had, we set up a date, he ended up postponing it, and then finally he said that he can't go on any other podcasts because some deal he's having. Mm-hmm. But me and Max came back on. Anyways, my point here is that you have a lot of this atrocity propaganda. If it's proven, no doubt about it, I'll be the first person to condemn any grape, I don't want to say explicit words, you know, the cutting, you know, like horrific, evil, disgusting things that get people to emotional crazy level, like we have to go attack these animals who are doing this. But then you had Chris Cuomo, who actually had Yusuf Basim on the program. And Yusuf Basim comes on.
Let's talk about October 7th. October 7th is a atrocity. It's a terrorist attack. It's terrible. Anthony Blinken went on in front of Congress and he testified about an incident.
A family of four, a young boy and girl, 6 and 8 years old, and their parents around the breakfast table. The father has eye gouged out in front of his kids. The mother's breast cut off. The girl's foot amputated. The boy's fingers cut off before they were executed. And then their executioner sat down and had a meal.
That is a direct testimony from Zaka and Hadzullah United.
They killed the husband first. They took his eyes out. I saw the body by myself. They cut the breast of the woman. They cut the leg of girl.
Two relief groups from Israel that they have actually been exposed that all of the stuff that they said has been lies. And they have collected more than $50 million of donations.
Ken, ani asafti yeladim v'tinokot b'li rosh.
Our volunteers, when they came into the homes and they saw the children beheaded.
If they were not busy raping women, they would have continued to Jerusalem.
Because of these unverified lies, and this has been reported by the Israeli media, Haaretz, Channel 13, and Time of Israel.
שנשחטו ופשוט הרגו אותם.
בתוך, אתה רואה את הילדים?
בית, שמונה תינוקות.
שמונה תינוקות.
נצחו שמונה תינוקות במעון בבארים אוויר.
ילדים, תינוקות שנקלו על חבל גביסה ממש בשורה אחת.
כמו בכפר עזה, אבל לכפר עזה הבהירו מזמן שהאירוע הזה פשוט לא קרה.
Pregnant women, cut open.
גם זה לא קרה. לראות שגם בייחוד הצלה, הפיצו בזמנו את הסיפור הפיקטיבי על כך שתינוק הושם בתוך תנור.
You've seen burn body. But in the same time in Israel, people talk about the Hannibal Directive, where the Israelis went in and indiscriminately they shot hellfire missiles from Apache. They shot shells from tanks. There is an Israeli survivor. Her name is Yasmin Porat. She came on a podcast and she talked about being in a house with 14 other hostages and 40 terrorists and said everybody was alive. And then the Israelis started to shooting all the 40 the terrorists and 12 out of the 14 hostages were killed. That's an 85% kill rate.
And he's giving also much of these facts, and he's showing that these relief organizations who were reporting a lot of these things, they were actually, like the 40 beheaded babies and all this stuff, these were debunked.
Yes.
So they were coming out, these relief organizations, making these claims, which later the Israeli reporters and people on the ground, they said these are not true, they're lies.
Right.
But they made $50 million in the process.
Yeah.
So people are still, Piers Morgan and others, Chris, they're still repeating the lies. What are your comments on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think
have
that,
you looked into this?
Yes, yes. I've read a bit of Max's reporting on this, and I do think that it does, look, it's very clear that there were exaggerations. There were claims that just were not actually true. It also seems kind of unnecessary because there were horrific things that happened on October 7th. And so it doesn't seem like why you have to then
anything,
lie on top of this.
Yeah, if anything is, if it's something that, you know, innocent people, we condemn.
Yes, of course. Now, of course, there were also attacks on military outlets, and that's a little bit of a different situation. That's not the same thing as attacking innocent civilians. You know, attacking a military that is keeping your people under blockade and, you know, continually bombing, that's a different That's at least a different moral question. But there is no question that Hamas did kill innocent civilians on October 7th. There is a question of what percentage of them were killed in crossfire with the IDF. There's a question of how much the IDF did there, and there should be a much more thorough investigation of all
of that.
That's
the point.
Yes.
Investigate everybody.
Yes. Well, you want to know. You want to get to the truth.
Investigate everybody.
Yes. But I think it's the
obvious... An independent outside organization to investigate.
Yes. But look, from my perspective, when I see almost everybody who takes the pro-Israel position on this is implicitly saying that they don't value Palestinian life as much as they value Israeli life. That is the overwhelming claim. It's the only reason why, for anyone, even if you buy this human shields argument that they're using, which is, you know, not exactly clear that it's founded in objectivity. But even if you buy that, if you go like, well, we just got a bombardment. We know we're going to end up killing all these kids, but we got to do it to try to get to this one Hamas guy. You would never accept that if the price was Israeli life. You know what I'm saying? Like, you would never accept, like, oh, I'm going to kill a whole bunch of innocent Israelis because we're getting one
here,
suspected
bad guy.
There's
a school shooting.
Yes, we should blow up the school. I mean, no one would accept. The only way to get there is if you fundamentally don't value Palestinian life as much as you value Israeli life or American life. And if you just look at it, if you just say, no, I think all life is precious.
All human life is precious.
All human life is precious. If you just take that position, then it's very easy to just get to the conclusion that, like, yes, it doesn't matter which side does it. Killing innocent civilians is inexcusable. You cannot do that. That's what makes us not savages. That's what makes us civilized people, is that we don't believe that that's okay. And if you just accept that, then, first of all, you'll accept that there's no way you can support this war in Gaza. And after that, the additional point to that, and this is kind of the back to what I was saying at the beginning, the Ron Paul point, is that it is just not true that the goal of this war is to eliminate Hamas, as they say. This war, if you understand anything about history, this war guarantees Hamas or a Hamas-like organization or this guarantees more terrorism. Short of killing the whole 2 million plus population in Gaza or ethnically cleansing all of them out of there is no way you can do this to a group of people and they will not want to violently respond to you. You're guaranteeing it for the future. And of course, this is human nature. Anybody did this to nobody. There's no group of humans in the history of human existence who would accept these conditions and not try to fight back.
What do you say as we conclude now for people who are caught in the in this and they're seeing, you know, the 4K images of the innocent children and whatnot, but they're torn between, you know, much of the slogans, the propaganda, the programming. Yeah. You went through what you went through, a lot of reading, a lot of studying. How can a person take a shortcut? What do you advise for somebody to get to the bottom, really what's going on?
Well, I would say Daryl Cooper's Fear and Loathing in the New Jerusalem, okay. It's very easy to access. It's audio, which a lot of people prefer, like listening to reading. I personally wish he had written it in a book.
That's for someone who wants to go deep. That's like
that's
20
a deep
hours
dive.
Or something?
Yes, yeah, it's okay. 20 plus hours.
Someone's like, you know, I don't have that much time. Anything else?
You don't have, well, look, I did on my podcast, I did a brief history of Israel.
Where's that?
It was a two-part series called Part of the Problem. That's my podcast.
Dave Smith?
You can find it on YouTube, on iTunes, yeah. GasDigital.com is where you can go through all the episodes. And that's just, it's a briefer version of it. Obviously, when you're giving an 80-year history in a couple hours, it's just, you know, hitting, like, kind of key points. But I would just say that, which I think the whole spirit of me and you sitting down is that you should feel free to reject the false paradigm. You should feel free to reject this thing where, like, if I want to be against this war, then I have to hate Jewish people. Or if I want to be against this war, then I have to support Islamic terrorism or something like that. And if you want, you know what I mean? If you like, all of that is nonsense. You don't have to trap yourself in that binary. There are people who fall into that binary, but they really are the minority. And people who are saying what you're saying and what I'm saying far outnumber those people. The people who are sitting here saying, no, I don't have anything against Jewish people. I have something against what the government of Israel is doing to the Palestinian people. And the people who are saying, no, I do not support Hamas. I don't support anyone who kills innocent people. But I am saying that I do support the innocent people who are living in Palestine and that their life is every bit as precious. You know, like, I'm a dad. I got little kids. Look, man, when you see the pictures that, you know, they were posting them in New York of the hostages, and they have pictures of babies up there. And stuff. I mean, I don't know exactly everything that happened. There hasn't been a full investigation. But you see that the idea that a baby died, it's just like the worst thing in the world to me. Yeah. I see my kids in that kid's face. But then I also see my kids in the faces of all these Palestinians. And I try to put yourself in the situation of imagining what that would be like. It's like the worst thing in the world that you could think of, that someone would ever do that to one of your kids. And that's what we should all, every human being, should be on the side of being against that. And that you would exhaust every conceivable option before you would ever accept that being done to anybody's kids.
What's our slogan? Where do we get this from? Freedom and liberty for all?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's what I like. That's what I'm all about.
So they want the freedom also to control their own water, their own air, their own able to build and to have not someone coming in, soldiers coming into their home, sleeping in their beds.
Yeah,
things that we would not stand for. You know, I often say we get pissed off if someone parks in our driveway.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, no, that's right.
Or takes their fence and maybe, you know, takes 2 inches from the survey, right, and goes over the property line.
That's right.
People ready to come out guns blazing.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. And look, no group of people would accept what the Palestinians have been given since 1967. And there's, you know, we should do more to encourage any peaceful solution to this.
Absolutely. And I just want to note, from an Islamic perspective, anytime, doesn't matter in war or anything, it's very clear. Non-combatants are to be non-touched.
Yes, this is that I am familiar with. Yes, that it's very clear.
There's a very powerful verse in the Quran, chapter 5, verse 32, saying killing one innocent human being, non-combatant, innocent human being, is as if you killed the world. Saving one innocent life is as if you saved the world.
Yeah, well, that's beautiful.
Yes. Thank you again.
Thank you. I really appreciate you coming to me. I appreciate it. I'm really glad we had this conversation.
I want you to look at, you have your Muslim friend here. If you have anything, any questions, anything on this end, you know, where they bring up like the RFK and what's her name and they try to bring Islam, please, if there's anything I can be there, you know, as a friend, look me up.
Thank you very much, my brother.
Thank you, brother.
We needed the Dean Center to be here. We are blessed, alhamdulillah.
We are here hard at work. Let's go ahead and take a look what's going on. Where are we at now?
We are almost done with the wudu area.
We're trying to finish the wudu area for the outside. Alhamdulillah, we did great achievements so far. Still much going on, you know, we need a lot of work. I really can't wait to have it finished.
Working hard to get the educational Dawah Center open so we can educate humanity on the most misunderstood way of life out there, yet the fastest growing Islam. So do your part and contribute, donate right now.
I cannot leave without giving you a gift. If you're not yet Muslim and you're tuning in to see what these Muslims are talking about and you like a free copy of the Quran, go ahead and visit thedeanshow.com. We'll take care of the postage and everything and get it delivered to you. And if you still have some questions about Islam, call us at 1-800-662-4752. We'll see you next time. Until then, peace be with you. Assalamu alaikum.